welcome to the Wagon Wheel. I'm Jared Kimber. Thank you very much for everyone for arriving. It's going to be a shorter show today, partly because it's school holidays and partly because there's a game in a little while. But we'll certainly get through to them. If you want to ask a chat and you're on the YouTubes, then obviously Super Chat is the best way to go. And if not, the best way of always to do it is to support us on Patreon, like Ankush has done, where he says, what do you think will be India's T2011 in the next ICC event? Do Jaiswal and Gill make it? Is Sanju the best among all the wicketkeeper batters India have? I am going to be very honest here, Ankush. I have spent no time thinking about this, barely thinking about things 5 minutes ahead of my time. It's just not the way my brain really, really works. Jaiswal and Gill would have to really impress me a lot for them to be automatic locks at the moment. Abhishek Sharma is the one that I would be thinking is the lock at the top amongst the wicketkeepers. I think what you do with wicketkeepers, unless there's an absolute standout, is you pick the best option that suits your team once you already have the other six players in place, right? Or five players in place, however you want to work that out. But yeah, I wouldn't get too far ahead of myself with that sort of stuff, especially with the wicketkeeper. But Abhishek Sharma's the one that I'd be putting on my list. Lemon says, what programs do you use to find stats such as batter scoring errors and ball tracking data? We've got partnerships on partnerships on partnerships, Lemon. I wish I could give you a great answer to something like that. But the truth is, I don't even always know exactly what we've used for each video. We have partnerships with MV Play. We have some other companies that give us stuff. Occasionally we have some people who have personal databases and everything. I wish it was free. I wish it was available. I wish everyone in cricket had access to it. Unfortunately, not the direction our sport's going in. Rudra says, suppose the IPL was interested in a 2-year-long World Test Championship style tournament, which played around the world. Which IPL franchises? I get asked this all the time. Which franchise would be most likely to effectively forfeit a test series for financial reasons like South Africa did? I do think we will eventually end up with this, by the way. I think this is far more likely to happen than anything else when it comes to test cricket. I don't think anyone will forfeit it because it would make money. This would make more money than what Test Cricket would make now. So you wouldn't get involved in it if it wouldn't make money. Which franchises? Most of the franchises are owned by people who are not T20 fans. So they're older guys who already like Test Cricket more in general. So I would assume that most of them would take it pretty seriously, if we're being honest, Rudra. I'm not sure there's, obviously the three main franchises who always win would probably do pretty well, would be my guess. Ian says, Dhoni's 26 of 11 today, following a catch, a stumping and a run out was proof that, as you've said, he's still a plus player in the IPL. But doesn't this just make his earlier appearance batting at 9 even more inexplicable? What was the perceived benefit of that? Look, it could have been matchup. It could have been a days when his knees were stiff. I can't remember if it was the first innings or second innings. I think it's okay. He's a plus player. Doesn't mean that he has to be used in every single situation all the time. I think there should be a flexibility with using older players. And, I've talked about this a lot. Russell Westbrook in the NBA, Vince Carter would be another one in the NBA. They're not going to be used the same at the end of their career as they are at the start. That doesn't mean they don't still have some of the same skills and they can't still be really useful, but you have to be more flexible with them. And you also have to know the days they may not have it. I think that's okay. It's just that batting at 9, great. But remember, I don't want to get all football here, but it's a false 9, isn't it? He's not actually batting at number 9. What he is doing is batting at number 8, which he probably has done a couple of times before, but it's number 9 because of impact subs and everything as well. So the batting lineups have changed a little bit. But yeah, it's probably still inexplicable. I watched a video on MS Dhoni with Bumble and TalkSport. I thought I had the losses under him in England, 2001, 2014, Australia, 2011. 2001, I said 2011. You've gone through a bunch of losses. How did these losses reflect on Dhoni, if at all? I believe you covered many of those series and perhaps India were just poor and incomplete beyond any remedy. So I just did a documentary today, which will be out on Indian TV. Probably during the England India series. And there was a bit of a narrative within it of like, how did Virat Kohli do stuff that MS Dhoni couldn't? And it's like, MS Dhoni was carrying a busted version of Ishant Sharma, who wasn't ready, who didn't understand how to get the most out of himself, who wasn't the kind of cricketer that he would become. And he was like the main seamer for a lot of that period. He had Zahir Khan, but Zahir Khan was quite often injured. They didn't quite have, if you look at 2011, they didn't quite have the all-round flexibility that they would go on to have. Ashwin's just making his debut around that time. Jadeja's still not, certainly not an all-round star at that point. So I just don't think they had a good team. This is why most conversations about captains are bullshit, Neil. When it comes down to it, it is how good is your team? Okay. Can you make slight improvements? Sometimes can you do something miraculous? Yes. right? More often than not, can you? Probably not. You've just got to, if you can't take 20 wickets, you're probably not going to win a lot of tests. Ben says, do you think we'll ever get to a time where the captain has an earpiece to talk to coaches, analysts? We've already done it, Ben. We had it in the 1999 World Cup. The cricket at the time decided they didn't want it. There's an element of, I think it would help, and especially as an analyst, it would have been great to get the messages across. But there's also an element of, isn't cricket more dynamic? Because, you know, the quarterbacks in the NFL, other than the Manning family, are basically just doing what the offensive coordinators want. Even in basketball, you see, you know, that handball, you see all that sort of stuff. Like the coach is just giving the advice. Isn't there something kind of great about the fact that cricket goes in the other direction? I don't mind if it eventually follows that, because I think it would improve the level of cricket on the field. But then we've got 70-year-old people making decisions and, you know, 50-year-old people making decisions. There's something kind of cool about a 26-year-old captain having to work it out on the field as well. It's kind of exactly the same conversation with the number 11s. I love the fact that number 11s have to go up against the best bowlers in the world. But I also understand for cricket to get better, we probably don't need that anymore, right? For the cricket on the field to get better. So it's whether you love the quirkiness or and the uniqueness in some ways and which direction you want to go in. What are some of the most unusual post-career post-careers jobs cricketers have had? Ricky Pondick started his own wine, was not on my bingo card. Heaps of players have started their own wine label. I don't know how, MF Jim, I don't know how much you followed this, but it's a really common thing. Marcus North did it. There was a period of time where I was just getting contacted by former players' wine companies over and over again. So that's a very common one. Who's the taxi driver? Was that Ewan Chatfield was a taxi driver? Obviously, in the amateur days, you got lots of random jobs in the old days. Was Colin Croft, did he become a pilot? I don't know if he was a commercial pilot, but I think he was. Certainly, he was a trained pilot, and I assume he was flying a plane. He once told me an anecdote that I swear went for 3 hours during a rain delay, and by the end of it, he still hadn't landed the plane in this anecdote. Henry O'Longa being an opera singer, that one comes to mind. I'm trying to think of some of the others. Me and Bryden Coverdale used to do two games on LinkedIn. One was fine, which was trying to work out a player's, find a player on LinkedIn and then trying to remember their first class batting average, which is so incredibly Bryden and me to do. And then the other one that we would do is we would look up specifically, because we were both Victorians, mostly Victorians, but a little bit of Tasmanian and South Australians as well. But we would look up cricketers from those three states, and one person would look them up and the other person had to guess what their job would be based on how they played cricket. And that's when you realize how, like, you don't actually know what someone is skillful at or not skillful at. Do you know what I mean? Like, they were like really sort of hard-headed fast bowlers where I was like, they're probably driving a truck now. And it's like corporate law for a finance company or something. So yeah, I think it's fair to say if you go to LinkedIn, you can find them, man. There's plenty of weird ones, but I think Alongas would have to be up there. Has anyone been a stand-up comedian? I mean, Max Walker's late career, Mike Whitney's late career in Australia are fascinating. Who was the English, was it Phil Edmonds, who became in some sort of global conspiracy to do with Africa and not good things with Africa? I didn't have that on my bingo card. Josh says, a few months ago, I pitched my idea of a CricPix 100th episode, mega special. We're 9 contestants, each draft their own men's test 11, plus an honorary 100th man to give the top 100 test players of all time. Do you think the other members of the team would enjoy it as a one-off and getting to compete on their own individual team? I don't know how it works. I don't know if we're quite at that level yet, Josh, from the perspective of, like, there's quite a lot of backroom stuff and who talks and when they talk in that one. It's probably something that we can look at. You're right. But I don't know if we're quite there at the moment. But I do think it's a good idea. But it's more a who talks when, is Bayram hosting and one of the people. Now we have Varun. Maybe Varun could be the host in that. But yeah, we're trying more and more things. I think when Robbie Utapa sees where we put him in his one, he might want to be on a couple. I've had some other players ask if they could be involved in some of them. So we will try and do more. There's no doubt about that. Rudra says, maybe not quite the same level as Sachin versus Smith or Ponting versus Kohli. But who was the better left-arm pace bowler all around it in each format? Sam Curran or Irfan Pathan? It's Irfan Pathan's. I remember him as a test bowler. What was his one-day numbers? Just because I can't quite remember his one-day record as much off the top of my head. So what did he play? 120 ODIs. 29.5. So a little bit expensive, but not terrible. I think if I was going to give this one, Rudra, what I would say is that it's probably, I'm trying to think of the best way of putting it. It's probably, I think Curran had maybe a slightly higher ceiling, but Irfan Pathan was the better bowler, all things considered, in all conditions at all times. So if I was picking someone and I wanted, and I was picking them at 21, 22, I might pick Sam Curran on the hopes that he can eventually become the bowler I think he can, but he hasn't. But if I was just picking someone, having known what they've done in their career, I'm probably much more likely to pick Irfan Pathan. I think I'm pretty happy with that. Mob King says, if we're able to isolate true stats for every single parameter and drive stats, also showing some players perform better or worse than their international career stats suggest, are we able to say to some extent that it is due to a razzle-dazzle of IPL product and not for any cricketing reason? The problem with anything like this, so, you know, people want clutch stats in cricket, like, and, it, you know, that kind of, I'm asked about that so often. And if you go through these sorts of things, you'll see just how often those sorts of questions are asked of me. And the issue that we have in cricket is it's not basketball or baseball, right? There isn't like hours and hours of clutch time. There aren't enough games and everything. I think, you know, there was that big thing that Chris Gayle didn't do very good in finals. And then you look up his record, his actual record in finals and playoff games was really good. But there's a couple of games that everyone remembered. And so I'm not sure. I do think he was a good player in finals. And I'm also not sure there's any proof that says he's not a good player in finals. And it's the same with the IPL. What if, for whatever reason, you are fully fit in April and May and the pitches suit you a little bit more? How do we factor that in more? Do you know what I mean? So I don't think that that is the case. There is certainly, I've always called it the Davis Cup effect. If you go back and have a look, there have been tennis players who were pretty ordinary tennis players when they were playing for themselves. And it was, I don't know, a midweek tournament in Amsterdam, right? There's a few crowd there, but it's not packed or whatever. And then they're playing in the Davis Cup and they've got all their teammates around them and they've got a coach to talk to on the court. Suddenly everything's different and they're like absolutely firing and it's, and like their brain is ticking over and they look like a completely different player. So there are different setups that inspire different players. I think that's probably fair to say. I don't know if we're in a position where stats can tell that just because we don't play enough games in cricket generally for that kind of information. Sandeep says, can you please talk about the characteristics of black and red soil pitches and how they affect play, especially in the subcontinent? It's really interesting that black and red pitches are very different in different parts of the world as well, which is something that is endlessly fascinating to me. If you're talking about in the IPL, you're generally... So again, they play very differently in test matches as well, right? And so if you look at, I'm just trying to see if I can see any, if we have anything. So there was, where are we here? I'm trying to see, there was an article I found a while back that was like a blogger who tried to go through it. And when they went through it, they looked at test cricket and they looked at around the world and I can't find it now. Okay. So essentially a black and a red pitch doesn't always mean that you know exactly what is going to happen. But what it comes down to is the amount of clay salt, I think, is part of it, and then sand. And there's something else as well, right? But essentially, what you have is in a red soil wicket, there isn't a lot of clay. And so generally, they absorb pitches, the moisture a little bit differently. They can produce very good bounce and they can be in a situation, and we're talking about the subcontinent here because they're very different in different parts of the world, but they can be in a situation where the it should help the spinners, but it should be like a more of a flat surface in a T20 game. A black soil wicket has a lot of clay, right? So in Australia, you have wickets that are probably made up of black soil, but actually have low clay content. So I think the MCG is one of those. And a lot of wickets, when I was growing up in Australia, apparently had those, right? The black soil in India can be a little bit of inconsistent bounce. It can be really flat though as well. So you might have a red soil pitch in Chennai, which is going to play very different than a red soil pitch in Australia or Dharamshala or somewhere else. So what you really need, this is why it's so confusing to write about. That's why I wish I could find that blog, but I can't find that blog. Essentially, what you're looking for is what the red soil does or the low clay content does in that region. So in general, in an area like in Chennai, we know that the red soil pitches like really rag, whereas they don't in other places as much, but they are generally drier and more consistent off balance. Black soil pitchers can often be the best batting pitchers though in the world, right? Which kind of goes against what I've just said, but they can also be really inconsistent. So there is no definitive answer if that's what you're looking for. What you're looking for is a ground by ground, and this is why cricket is so fascinating, right? You could have the same exact pitch content in a red and a black one. And they have this at the ICC. It's fascinating listening to them. In fact, I might try and get Tony Hemmings to talk about that. I think he's going to come on my podcast soon. You can put the exact same, like, sometimes they will bring over a surface from Australia or from South Africa or from India and put it in at Dubai. And it doesn't act the same as it does in Australia or South Africa or Dubai or India. So it's not as simple as that is a red pitch, so it will only do this. Some red pitches can keep low. Some red pitches can get more bounce. But generally when we're using it, we are saying this red pitch at this surface is a good batting pitch and the ball comes on, but it should spin. This black pitch at this surface will be inconsistent of bounce. And this black pitch and this surface might be a great batting pitch. We're trying to give as much information as possible, but it's really tricky. It really is. Oh, sorry. Went too early on that one. It is a really confusing one. Anyway, let's have a quick break. And when we come back, there will be, you know, more of all of these things. Just more. It's always more.
If you need a VPN, go Nord. Use nordvpn.com/Kimber to get a 2-year contract with a discount, plus 4 extra months, plus gifts in some markets. It's completely risk-free with Nord's 30-day money-back guarantee. The link is in the show notes. Protect your computer like a blocker protects the stumps with NordVPN today.
All right, welcome back. Next question is from Adityan, who says, when did the index finger carom ball start? The older carom ball was flicked out with the middle finger and then came along. Okay, I see what you're saying. I'm pretty sure, in fact, it's on here, isn't it? So this is Iverson's one. So this is the original back from the early 60s. And you could see, sorry to everyone on the audio, but if you know the Good Areas logo, you know what I'm talking about. You can see here, 100%, that is the middle finger flicking it. So the carom ball through Ajunta Mendes, through Rangana Harath, so it was Harath first, then Mendes, those sorts of people. I think most people did that. And that is, I believe, how you do the actual carom flick, although I'm not an expert, right? But that's certainly why it was given that name. People started doing the other one because it comes, one of the reasons is, even though that finger's not as strong, it comes from a slightly different angle. I don't know who the first person to do it is. I know that Ashwin and was certainly playing with it, because I remember talking to someone who was chatting to him about it. That was quite a while back now. And so I think around that period, what has happened over the last couple of years is, and we've seen this with Usman Tariq, the Pakistani bowler as well, that people are just experimenting with all different kind of flicking styles at the moment. So you are seeing a lot more experimentation than we've ever seen before. But I haven't heard anyone say they were the one who sort of came up with it first, or, you know, or came about it from that point of view. So I can't give you an exact answer there. Rob Blakey says, I frequently hear on cricket podcasts comments along the lines of, there aren't enough high quality cricketers to fill all the positions in leagues and first class competitions. The quality of cricket is being diluted. And I only want to watch the best versus the best, but other professional sports have deep benches and don't play their best team every game and still draw crowds. Won't cricketers improve their level in professionalism as the game grows, like the women cricketers do? Yeah. We have, about 3,500 professional men's cricketers. I haven't got the recent numbers. Tom Moffat was supposed to come on the podcast, and he will in a couple of weeks when he's over in the UK, and we'll do something. But he hasn't come on the podcast yet. And that was, I wanted to get the updated number on that. They might have released it, and I just missed it. We've never had this many professional cricketers at the level that we've had now. So I think that's fine. But what we're seeing is that the IPL is not the best of the best, because you have the Indian, the overseas limited players. So it's not quite the best of the best. And so much of international cricket's not the best of the best. It's very rare in top level sports, let's say the NBA or, you know, Premier League football or baseball, to not have the actual best of the best out there a good majority of the time. And in cricket, you could argue that outside of World Cups, maybe we don't. And we don't play World Cups all that often. So I can see the argument from that. But yeah, no, the game is so much better, Rob, because of the amount of professionals that are playing. And the women's cricket is a perfect example of that. What have they got, about 500 professionals? The game is so much stronger than when there was zero professionals, but even when there was like 100. MF Jim says, how many different hats have been worn in cricket? Baggy caps, normal caps, wide brim with the floppy variant, terry toweling. Terry Towling count as the floppy variant? Like, it's kind of a bucket hat, isn't it? So you've had baseball caps, baggy caps, wide brim, the two different wide brims, as you say, the Terry Towling, which I would say is still a variation of that. I would assume in the old days you would have had the caps that they used to wear without the peak on them. You would have had top hats in the old days as well. I'm trying to think if there's anything else I'm missing. There's obviously some of the weird helmet designs, early helmet designs, which if you want to count them as hats, MF Jim, because they kind of were hats. So there's the safari hat that the Indian cricket, I should remember his name. I was only writing about him the other day. Son of Gavaskar did a version of that. There's an English cricketer who did a version of that. So there's a few different versions there. Those are the main ones that I can think of. And then, of course, you've got the umpires' hats as well, which are slightly different again. And they've changed quite a bit as well. And also changed from country to country at different times. You would think I'd be an expert on cricket hats. Apparently, I'm not. Or maybe I was. Lemon says, has McGurk been worked out, or is he having one of the worst runs of form we have seen? I think there's an element of being worked out. I don't think that means what people think it means, though. I think what people think that means is, that's it. He'll never come back again. What it really means is, he came in with a specific style that was quite limited but very effective. Teams have worked out how to bowl to that style, and he is now going to have to develop something to counter that. He's young enough and talented enough to do that. His eye is ridiculous. You can't do what he has been doing even for 10 games without having a great eye. And we're seeing him and who's the other big, the other guy from from Tasmania that played in the SA20, whose name I've forgotten? I feel like it's another Mitch, but I could just be saying that because everyone's called Mitch. But is it Mitch Owens? I just think now people that the you know I'm not even a professional analyst. Like, I'm not working for any team, and I can go through and have a look at this stuff now. Like, it's so accessible. Like, and it doesn't take long. Reggie says, I listened to the episode where you discussed the Saudi Slam on two different podcasts. What offer would you need from the organizers of Saudi Slam to become part of their tournament in a journalistic or commentator podcast capacity? This isn't entirely a flippant question. I'm not going to go and work for Saudi cricket. I've worked for Cricket Australia before. I've worked for the ECB before. I had job interviews with, I suppose you'd say the BCCI. It was more with IMG for IPL. I've done stuff behind the scenes for, well, not USA Cricket, but Major League Cricket. But I've talked to USA Cricket. I've obviously worked for Scotland. Those are all organizations that, while I don't agree with everything they've done, and I don't agree with all the people who work for them, they're all organizations that like cricket and are interested in cricket. I'm not really looking to work with the Saudi people. I would sell my stuff to them, and I would, if I had a business entity, I've got no problem selling it onto Saudi Arabia, because I would not be partnered with them. I wouldn't commentate with them or anything like that. Journalistically is different, because if they offer me the option to come over and do journalism and I can do it the way that I want to do it, then that's very different. That I might accept. But yeah, I'm not interested in doing PR. And I've knocked back PR jobs with other cricket boards before. I might be one day, right? I still think Saudi Arabia is probably away. There is an element of sponsorship is a little bit different. And there are certainly companies that have probably sponsored me before that, you know, are not great. We try and weed out the ones that we really don't think should be involved. And we haven't taken a major betting sponsor here, although we probably will. But we haven't taken a major betting sponsor. I just don't massively feel confident with... I don't massively feel confident at the moment with the setup over there. But if they showed that it was about cricket and that they hired people who like cricket, then at one stage, like, I disagree with the Saudi government. I disagree with most governments in cricket, right? Like... I've never lived in a country and voted for a government that I've liked. I'm not sure that would, you know, that I can make it on those things. But if it is about washing their PR, then I think I quite rightly have some concerns with that. You have to be clever. I've worked with owners that aren't particularly good. Like, I work at TalkSport, and Rupert Murdoch is the owner, right? Like, I'm not saying he's trying to sports wash or anything, but I'm pretty sure me and Rupert Murdoch don't agree on many different things. I work for Walt Disney. I certainly don't agree with Walt Disney's political takes. Do you know what I mean? So I suppose you do have to look at it from that perspective, but I'm not rushing out. If the Saudi money comes in, realistically, it's better for everyone who works in cricket anyway, because there will be more jobs available and there will be more movement, right? It's the same with The Athletic. I know a lot of people who didn't take the money from The Athletic when they were offered it, be it in America or in the UK. And it's partly because they didn't like the way The Athletic had done things. Sometimes they didn't want to go behind a paywall, but everyone had their own thing. But they all got paid more, whether they worked for The Athletic or not, because so much money and interest came into the game that it actually changed the media landscapes in those places. And the same thing would happen here. But yeah, I'm probably not going to take that money. I mean, it's hard. We're looking for investors at the moment for our company, and we've got, quite advanced talks with some people, and with others, we've just had early talks. Some of the money, with Death of a Gentleman, there were, different kinds of people that probably invested in it that if we'd had time, but sometimes you just have to take the money. It's a tough world. We live in a capitalist world, right? Like, there you go. Neil says, I remember you saying that Monkey Gate provided a great opportunity to provide a different perspective via Cricket with Balls. How was your coverage different to the Aussie and Indian press, and what were your takeaways to the actual event? Everyone else who was covering that event was covering it by taking sides because they all worked for media organizations where taking sides made sense. Both sides did stupid things. I said that this side did a stupid thing. Anil Kumble getting into a situation where he's going to take the Australian fielder's word for it with 100 and something years history, 130 years history of us knowing that Australian fielders will claim everything. I mean, what are we talking about, Anil? You're not an idiot. Why would you do that, right? Sachin Tendulkar changing his story, right? And then you got the Australians and everything that went on with Australia. The amount of times that they had quite openly bullied players about their sexual orientation, their ethnicity, their background, their accent and everything, suddenly getting upset that one of their players was getting abused. Like, that's what I talked about. I talked about the hypocrisy. I talked about the nonsense of it. But mostly I reveled in it was a magic series to cover. There was something happening every single day going back. And also having a blog like Cricket with Balls that wasn't taking particularly seriously when I started that series. I wasn't in the press box or anything. I just said what I said. And so it exploded. And so looking back on it, I would probably not be that happy with everything I said. But I was really clear in that I'm going to come to this with an independent mind and be like, okay, well, India threatening or suggesting they might go home, that's not good for cricket, right? Australia trying to force bully teams into these decisions of we're going to take the fielder's word for it, that seems like it's a system that could easily be done here. Andrew Simon should not be racially abused, right? All these different things, it allowed for that. I've said before, I think it's one of the most interesting series in the history of cricket. And I'd love to go back and have a look at it again. But before I came along, independent cricket journalism didn't really exist. If you said you're independent before, what you really meant was you were English, but you followed other teams. Sandeep says, please share a small, impactful piece of wisdom from the art of batting that you haven't shared elsewhere. Oh, impactful piece of wisdom. It's a really, it's not like it's a batting manual, the art of batting, right? I don't know if I'm trying to think of something very specific that is in the book that I wouldn't have covered somewhere else that is like a piece of wisdom. I probably have shared this somewhere else, but I don't know what I've shared and what I haven't shared, Sandeep. But the one thing that I was really fascinated in and that Rahul Dravid really brought up, and then I talked to a few other players about it afterwards as well, was this whole idea of, think of the collective knowledge of the 50, even the top 80 best batters of all time. It's probably about 110 if you count the guys that were really good but had short careers. So let's say there's 110 great batters, right, in the history of men's cricket. There has not been one of them who has had a great son. There's been some good sons. Sanjay Mandrekar, right? There's a couple others that I'm forgetting as well. There's been some very good sons. There has not been another great batter. So all that knowledge and all that interest and passion and everything can't be pushed on to another person. I find that is fascinating in a sport where we have so many brothers playing, we have so many father and son duos. It's an incestuous sport. Look at New Zealand cricket, right? But we don't have that. Now, we eventually will have it, right? But, Arjun Tendulkar is not a batter. Don Bradman's son, not particularly a great batter. Didn't even make it to professional level cricket and could play, wasn't a bad player or anything. Sometimes we've had like it skipper generation. So the best one would be the Chappell family, right? Where you've got Clem Hill, then you've got his dad, the dad who was a good player, and then the grandsons come through. But it's still skipping a generation. So again, Clem Hill, who's this legendary voice in Australian cricket, couldn't get his son to that level. I think for me, that's what it is. And I was talking to, who was it recently? Someone was saying, someone who worked in cricket, he said he thought it was easier to train someone to be a great batter than a great bowler because there was so much athleticism. And I said, the thing that we can't train with batting is simply the ability to watch the ball out of the hand for 3 meters and then readjust to where it's going to be and then play the right cricket shot. And that's what these dads can't do for their sons. From Virat Kohli's MCG 6 against Pakistan to Bumrah's stump-destroying Yorker to Ollie Pope, incredible things happen on the cricket ground. We also get iconic lines off it, like Siraj saying, "I only believe in Jesse Bhai." There are so many incredible moments that cricket fans just never forget. And now you can wear them on your chest. Free Hit Gear has launched a line of amazing t-shirts and hoodie designs. Passionate fans in India can order through their website, freehitgear.com, while fans abroad can use Free Hit Gear on the Etsy store to have items delivered to them. Order now with the code GOODAREAS, or one word, to get a limited time 15% discount, and you can wear a t-shirt like this one right here. Ali says, if there was a global franchise league where there were no restrictions on foreign or domestic players, how many teams in that league would be appropriate to make the league competitive and yet high quality? Well, you could have about 15 teams, couldn't you? 20 teams? If you were doing that, I would have thought, Ali. Like, there's a lot of good cricketers around the world. Yeah, let's say you got, 80 players out of India. You can get another 120 to 140 from everywhere else. I would have thought so. Anyway, Satchmo says, who is the best batter of all time on a wet wicket? I mean, the numbers, and Satchmo, you do as much historic research as I do. The only numbers I've ever seen are Victor Trumper's. So I would assume that means it's Victor Trumper. It's really, I don't have, there isn't a database that has everyone's records on wet wickets. But from what I've been told, it's Victor Trumper. And he had the ability to score big runs on wickets where no one else made any runs. So I would assume it was him. We also know that he prepared for those wickets. So wet wickets were actually tougher to play in Australia, South Africa, West Indies than they were in New Zealand and England because the pitches are harder. And so when it's basically when the wetness starts to dry is when those wickets get really, really tough because you get fast bounce that is vertical because the ball hits the pitch and comes up. So if you've ever, and I played on uncovered wickets in Australia. And so I have a lot of experience playing on these kinds of wickets. It's a completely different style of batting. You can almost drop the bat on the ball because it's coming so vertical at times. And so it was probably harder in Australia. So you would expect, and I think it was thought to be at its hardest in Australia because of the hardness of the wickets. And you still got rain and then you got sun. And so the combination of the two, or the three, I should say. But yeah, so I would say it should have been an Australian, and Victor Trumper is the name I've heard, but I'm not an expert in that. I just haven't done research on it. Bloody Bugger says, given that Sri Lanka only got test status in 1981, did they get good at fielding unusually quickly compared to subcontinental neighbours? Of course, Pakistan still has issues with fielders, and even India used to be poor. I mean, India just, I would say, even though they have some great fielders now, they had some pretty poor fielders in the last World Cup as well. There's, you know, it's not like they've completely fixed their issues. I don't know. It could just be a cultural thing, right? Fielding always really mattered to Australians and South Africans and New Zealanders. It didn't matter to England, right? It mattered to West Indies as well. It didn't matter in the subcontinent. Like what? That's a cultural thing. Something to do with outfields and diving as well. Like if you're in the subcontinent, you don't want to dive on some of those fields, maybe played a part of it. And West Indians don't like diving probably for a similar reason. Whereas on lush Australian wickets, on pitches, even when the ground is hard, you've got a lot of grass to land on. But why don't they dive in England, right? And I'm talking historically, not now, obviously, where most people do. So I don't know. Is it something to do with that as well? But you're right, bloody. The only thing I would say with Sri Lanka is that they were probably ready for test status 30 years before they got it. I don't even believe in test status, but let's imagine I lived in a world where I did. They should have got it a lot earlier. Ankush says, who will take over from Rohit, Kohli and other Indians in the test setup, which Indian batter? You've asked two of these questions, Ankush. It's not particularly how my brain looks, right? I suppose Shreyas Iyer, now that he's a little bit more back in, I was going to say in fashion, but in vogue, would be someone that you'd be looking at going there. I think Shubman Gill wants to move down the order. So there's an element there as well. I'm not too, there's a lot of talent coming through. So when those players go, it'll be interesting to see if how much of it goes to, I'd be more interested in how much of it goes to 26, 27, 28 year olds who are coming into their peak, and how much of it goes to 20 year olds or 19 year olds or 22 year olds who are coming through. That would be the more interesting question for me from that point of view. Rob says, not a serious question. Bob Lloyd has been known as Bumble forever. What's your nickname going to be? Well, I used to write under Uncle J-Rod, and I still get people stop me occasionally and call me Uncle J-Rod, who remembered me from Cricket with Balls. J-Rod has been my nickname for about 20 years. Kimbo, I get called a bit. I mean, Robbie started calling me Kimbo, and like, I've got other friends who call me Kimbo, and I've never said the all-father. I think J-Rod has probably been the one that has stuck. I'm trying to think, did I have another one when I was a kid? The only cricket one, or the only other nickname I ever had was a cricket one, which was Tuffers. When I played for North Melbourne in Dowling Shield, I came in and I was probably one of the best fielders in the side. I wasn't one of the best players, but I was probably one of the best fielders in the side. But I was a little bit unpolished. And so I think some of the other fielders looked down on me. But hilariously, when we had the most simple fielding drill of all time, everything that was smashed at me, I stopped. But one went up in the air and I was a slip fielder. And I don't know what it was. I just dropped a really simple, it wasn't even a high catch. And they just all called me Toughers. And by the end of that series, I was fielding at cover, mid-wicket and point. And they were still calling me Toughers. Like, it just didn't go away. But yeah, J-Rod is probably the other one. When I was really young, I was called the White Lion because there was Kimber the White Lion. But it's too long a nickname, White Lion. It just didn't stick. I mean, I'm happy with it. It's fine. I was briefly called Jord by some people as well. Mostly people just mispronounce my name. You would think it's a simple name, but so many people have trouble with the G and the J sound. But so many people see it as Gerard. It's one of those things of my name is being mispronounced so much that I don't worry about it at all. And so I actually have to retrain myself to be like, no, I have to get this player's name right. Whereas in my head, I'm like, it doesn't matter. No one's ever got my name right. Like, if you go in the commentary, Bumble says my name correctly, but Alex Tudor and Gareth Batty don't. And there are just certain people who can't. When I first started meeting people who couldn't say my name correctly, it shocked me. And then after a while, you're just like, oh, okay, they're not doing it on purpose. So it's probably be more of those sorts of things. Adityan says, does a bowling side like CSK not have a place in modern T20 game? Granted that their batters are out of form and will eventually find their feet, but their bowling attack has also been troubling. They have two stroke bowlers in Khalil and Noor, and an elite defensive bowler in Pathirana who can also get you wickets. The thing about a bowling side is you need all five bowlers to be good at the same time. You don't need that with a batting side. You can have two guys in form sometimes. Even one guy in form can carry you for a section of it. With bowling, you never get away with that. And Ashwin has been dropped and Pathirana is not at his best. And Jadeja's been fine, but not spectacular. So that's the problem with the bowling thing. If they're all in form, it's the Rajasthan Royals team when they had the five bowlers all in form for a little period of time with no backup. You need to be able to do that. And if you don't, then it causes some issues. All right. Let us get to the comments, the super chats, and then the game has started. And so I need to go over. Now I'm going to have to catch up as well, but I was always going to have to. Walking Alive with his super chat says, how is Bradman better compared to others? What kind of average would he have if he played today? We've done that video before, 60 or 65 or more. What actually made him good compared to others? Professionalism, conditions. I think he had the same thing that AB de Villiers has or Garfield Sobers has or George Headley has, which is that extra time. Brian Lara is another one. They just have extra time. So those players just pick up length. So a great test player will pick up length really quickly. A great test batter. Sometimes they'll also pick up line really quickly. And the greatest will pick up line and length really quickly, which is your AB de Villiers level, where it looks like the game is literally being slowed down. Have a look at some of the old footage of Garfield Sobers. It's incredible. How late he moves, and yet he's still ahead of the ball. So that is obviously what Bradman. He also had the ability to pick the field, the bowler, on all the other micro skills. Like he knew what the bowler was going to bowl before when the bowler didn't always know when the bowler was going to bowl. So not all the great players I've just mentioned had that skill as well. So he could pick line quicker, he could pick length quicker. He was very fast. So athletically, he was very fast to move into position. So let's say someone like Inzi. Inzi was brilliant at picking up line and length and was quite quick for someone of his size, but Inzi is always going to move slower and Jesse Ryder is always going to move slower probably compared to Virat Kohli or Ricky Ponting or Don Bradman. right? So the athleticism that he had was incredible. He wanted to get better. He practiced to get better in an age where that wasn't, I'm not saying other people weren't doing that, but they were doing it in a very limited way. So he was professional when everyone else was amateur. And if you look at the greatest early athletes, that's quite often part of it, right? You know, Susie Bates. Why is Susie Bates Susie Bates? Part of it is because she was thinking like a professional when no one else was. You see heaps in associate cricket and women's cricket now, or less so in women's cricket, but in women's cricket of 10 years ago. But Bradman was already there. He just wanted to keep facing every ball. He didn't get bored. Sachin Tendulkar didn't get bored. Steve Smith doesn't get bored. Len Hutton doesn't get bored. Mark Waugh got bored. Kevin Peterson got bored. Aravinda De Silva got bored. It sounds silly, but that is an incredible skill to have. Gavaskar and Cook and Boycott do not get bored. They just want to keep facing the next ball. But they don't have all the other skills that Bradman has. So yeah, I think it's all that. What kind of average have you played today? We've done this before in a whole video. I don't know if there's an actual mark that you can give him. But if you're looking at how much better he'd be than the other players today, he would have unique challenges that he never had to go up against. If you just took him from 18 and fast forwarded him now, I don't think he'd be very good. But if Bradman grew up in this era and had the brain that we obviously had, I think he would find a way to still be a great batter. Would he still be 20% better than everyone else, 40% better than most players? I don't know. But there are a lot of people that had advantage. Like, he didn't grow up in the middle of a cricket hotspot, as in he didn't grow up in Sydney or Mumbai, right? Or Melbourne or Mumbai or London or Chennai, right? He didn't grow up in an area where like everyone was great. He actually grew up in the country where there were some good cricketers, don't get me wrong. And there's a structure of cricket in Australia that had been around for like 100 years by the time he comes around. But he didn't grow up in like a hotbed in the way that maybe someone like Gavaskar, Tendulkar, Smith did, right? These guys grew up in a hothouse. So what is it possible that Bradman and Headley, and the two of them are really interesting because neither of them really did. You know, Headley didn't even pick up cricket until he was slightly older than other people, right? He was playing rounders in Panama. So would they have been even better if they'd been from that? I don't know what the correct answer to that is. Stark's reality. Oh, someone, I just seen someone before was about headbands. We have had some headbands in cricket, of course. Dennis Lilly, was he one of the first headbands? But Stark's reality says, Jared, why don't we have a top type cricket trump cards for different formats and IPL? Tops? Cricket card. Here's my Marazan cap. Who else do you want? I've got a Colin Ingram here. Can I interest you in a Colin Ingram? I've got a KS Ahmed. It's to do with the companies. Karen Pollard. I've got a Karen Pollard here as well. I just collect the ones from the players. Topps gave me a whole box once. I would happily, I'm probably the ideal person to be involved with this sort of stuff and help. So if there is a Topps company or Upper Deck, do Upper Deck still exist? More than happy. Ezekiel would be all over this. He loves them and he wants another box of these cards. So if you do it, I just don't think it's been as big a thing in modern cricket. Traditionally, if you go and have a look, MF Doom. Why are there so many MF Doom fans like me? Like, I'm a big fan of MF Doom. I'm on it. But anyway, if you go and have a look at eBay and you put in old cricketers' names, there are old cricket cards. It used to be cigarette cards in those days, right? And even from the 80s and 90s, I've got a Ramiz Raja card from the 80s somewhere that I found, and I've never lost it. I know it's in one of my books, but I can't find it. So yeah, why it hasn't happened in modern times, it hasn't been a modern thing for any cricket culture outside of Australia. And so it hasn't quite caught on. And so that sort of panini thing in football hasn't really transferred to cricket in the UK. Footy cards were bigger than cricket cards in Australia as well. I do think that this is a thing. I don't know if cards are going to continue to be a big thing, but, you know, it should happen. And someone's just said this to me before. I did get confused. I got confused with my old cricketers. Nagarjun says, Chappell's granddad was Vic Richardson. Of course it was Vic Richardson, not Clem Hill. Different era cricketers as well, but they're both old and they played a lot of cricket. So the cards, it just doesn't seem to have been as consistent. There have been times when cricket cards have been big in Australia, India and England, and they're the three markets that it's going to make the most sense in. I don't know if it's ever been big in all three at the same time, and it certainly hasn't been big of recent times. I wonder if, for whatever reason, you could make them big altogether. That would be more interesting. And I would also assume that there hasn't been enough promotion of them. Like, when I contacted Topps, and Topps were not they gave me a bunch of the cards, but they didn't seem that interested in like following it up or anything. Like I would have done heaps of work on them because I collected sports cards when I was a kid. I got into basketball as much as anything through basketball cards. I used to have old footy cards and I had cricket cards, like literally the kind of person that should be helping with these sorts of things. And it hasn't quite worked. Anyway, thank you very much for that generous super chat as well, Starks Reality. I think that is everything we have here today. The game's on. I'm 20 minutes in. But thank you very much to everyone for being on this live. Wagon Wheel, Good Areas Live, all those sorts of things. And we will see you again very shortly for more of this kind of thing here on the Good Areas channel. Thank you for listening. This podcast has an ad-free version via Patreon, where there are also many other extras as well, including a Discord channel where you can chat to me directly. There is a link to the Patreon in the show notes. We are an independent podcast, so support us any way you can. Maybe give us a review, subscribe, or share on social media. All of these things help us. And when it comes to podcasts, word of mouth is always the best way of making it grow. If we had a guest on, chances are their socials are in the show notes. Please support everyone who comes on this show. I am Jared Kimber, and this is my network. But we also have hosts and co-hosts like Baron Kazi and Estelle Vassadevan. This network is overseen by Nick McCorriston, and each episode is produced by Ishit Kaburka at Sound Potion Studio. Mukunda Bandredi, or Muku as most people will know, is the head of our YouTube channels, and he also helps out with so many other things like the podcast recordings. And there's so many other people we could thank here, but I just want to thank all the listeners and all the people who help behind the scenes that make this podcast work. If you make a lot of content like me, you will need help. And that is why we use Minvo.pro, a slicing and dicing tool that uses AI to conjure up great clips from your podcast chats and meetings. If you make content, go to Minvo.pro to cut it.